Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsive day for the second day of Rosh Chodesh Iyar, meaning really the first day of actual Iyar. We start with thanking the OU, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, for their help in putting this shiurim online. Today we're going to see, and I stumble across these things, these are tshuvot I would never have found if not for this project. This is a tshuva from Shut Mishpat Kohen. This is Rav Cook's tshuvot about Eretz Yisrael. It's from Sivan Samach Gimel from Responsum 63. He wrote it in Yafo on the second day of Rosh Chodesh Iyar of Tuf Reish Samach Tet of 1909. And it's about the Hetem Mechira. So that's just a brief recap for what I know as an ordinary 21st century Jew living, you know, in the world, that in the late 1800s, when the new yeshuv, the new settlers in Israel, were facing the problem of Shemitah and how to handle when they had the agriculture at the time was a delicate business and they were barely making it as it was, the idea of losing a year of planting and reaping was really unbelievable. They couldn't imagine it as being something that could happen and work out. And there was discussion about it, but Rav Yitzchak Kohen Spector, among others, allowed what was called the Heter Mechira. They allowed them to technically sell the land of Israel, as we technically sell our chametz to non-Jews for Pesach, and we think of that as being sufficient to get us away from the problem of owning chametz on Pesach. So too, Rav Yitzchak Kohen Spector and others held for various reasons, some of which we'll see in this tshuva, that you could sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew and then work the land, and that would work, and that would be avoid the Shemitah problem. The economy didn't immediately pick up, and so that in later Shemitah comes every 7 years, and later Shemitah, the same issue came up. And there was, I think as far as I can tell, a Shemitah year coming up, meaning I think that the year 5670, right, 5670 was going to be a Shemitah year. That was going to be the year of 1909 to 1910 was going to be a Shemitah year. So I think they're having that conversation in anticipation of that. And Rav Cook is thinking, has said that he thinks that it's okay to still rely upon this Heter Mechira. Heter Mechira was given at a time when there was great economic stress, and they said in the Heter, it's because it had great economic stress. Rav Cook felt that was still true. They could still rely on it, and others disagreed. So he's writing to Rav Yaakov David, who he calls a Mofes Hador. I'm not sure who it is, but I got your letter, and I got it when I was in Petah Tikva. Now I've come, and I have a chance to look at it, talk about it. Okay, and he says essentially he says we agree. So you don't know what the other letter said because we don't have it in front of us, but we're going to find out over the course of the tshuva. I think it's that this Rav Yaakov David thought they should be relying on the Heter Mechira. They should not be trying to sell Eretz Yisrael for various reasons he's going to say. Now Rav Cook is going to say, I fundamentally agree with you, but I want to explain the differences in our point of view. He says, first of all, I don't think there's anything to question about the Heter. It's by, you know, great Rabbanim, and their halachic logic, he thinks, is very solid, but that doesn't mean here, and this is the part I think where he's agreeing with the man who wrote the letter, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to find ways that we should hope that Hashem can give us the opportunity that we won't have to rely on it, that our brothers at Bnei Yisrael, who are living in Eretz Yisrael, could have the ability to fulfill the mitzvah of Shemitah with all of its halachot without having to do anything to get rid of it. And he says in any part of Eretz Yisrael, any part of the land of Israel that can be held in Jewish hands throughout the Shemitah year, and then you can fulfill the laws of Shavuot as with all of their laws, we should be thrilled about that. He calls it a kemotzei shalal raf, like somebody who's found a great booty, a great treasure. Where we start to disagree, he doesn't say it that way, but chalila lanu, it should be terrible for us to think that we should start looking down on Jews who have a horah from a rav, they have a permissibility from a rabbi telling them, from a reputable, authoritative rabbi telling them they're allowed to sell their Eretz Yisrael. So even though it's true that that's not mishnat chasidim, it is not the way the most concerned Jews would act. So this, and I'll go into Rav Cook in a second more, I just want to pause and think about that for a second and recognize that issue. Right? This is what Rav Cook is so careful to note, both sides of it. We want maximal halachic observance, and not just halachic observance in terms of what's allowed or not allowed. We want maximal halachic observance that if there's a halachic value to doing something, even though there's a way to do it otherwise, we should want and hope that we do it in the best way possible, even if it's permissible to do it another way. He's going to give other examples as we go along. In each case, we should think about that. So here he's saying, the fact that there are Jews who feel unable to live with a Shemitah right now and have halachic ways of not having to live with a Shemitah, of having halachic ways of getting around it, Of course, it's not as good as if they could live with the Shemitah. And I don't know what their economic situation was back then. I'm pretty sure it was significantly more tenuous and problematic than, thank God, the situation by and large in Israel today, even though in Israel today there are many people who don't have an easy time making a living and finding their livelihood. Okay, so now back to Rav Kook. He says we should notice and be upset about and be sad about Shiflut Keren Yisrael, how downtrodden the Jewish people are, and the economic situation is how bad it is of the Jews who are living in Eretz Israel or come to live in Eretz Israel. They have to, because of this pressure, use the Heter Mechira. Right? They have to get themselves away from this obligation of Shabbat Haaretz, of the land lying fallow and resting in the seventh year. So, and he says, so, but what are we going to do about it? After all, the Torah is a Torah Shlema, right? And if the Torah includes the possibility of finding a way around it for these people who feel the need, they have to get around it, then Ra'ui L'chol G'dolei Yisrael, all great Torah scholars should be menachem shvurei. He says, "Lenachem shvurei leiv hamuchrachim," to comfort them. They're brokenhearted at the fact that they have to rely on this Heter Mechira. We should comfort them to make sure they don't get too down on themselves and think of themselves as rishaim. Right? He thinks we have to do both sides. We have to try hard to make sure that we do as best we can, and while at the same time, we also make sure that people who feel who have to, from force of circumstance, do less than the best possible thing, make them feel comfortable as well. Now, I think he has just laid out here a tremendous, this is me talking, so if you don't like my digressions, I apologize, but I think these are important ones to notice within the tshuva. He has outlined here a terrible problem of halacha, and then of how to react to halachic observance, meaning that now creates all sorts of judgment calls that have nothing to do with halacha. Let's assume this isn't true for all people in the halacha conversation, but let's assume that everybody in a certain halacha conversation agrees that Yitzchak Osmanek Spector laid out valid halachic mechanisms by which one could not have to observe Shemitah in Eretz Yisrael if cases of financial stress called for it. And let's also assume that everyone in the halakhic conversation agrees. It would be better, however, to keep the Torah the way the Torah laid itself out in the simplest way, which would include leaving the land to lie fallow on a Shemitah year. Now you get to the hard question, because Rav Kook will tell us, well, so if there's a farmer and the farmer says to you, I can't let the land lie fallow. I can't do that. I can't financially make it that way. And therefore, I need the Heter Mechira. So today, it's even more complicated. I think there are other ways around it, too, that people have. We'll get to that. We won't talk about that now at all, but that's something to think about, right? Today, there's the Otzar Beit Din that people have, and there are people who only buy from non-Jews. There's sorts of ways around it other than those two, but I'm not getting into that because that's not in this tshuva. So in this tshuva now, let's wonder for a second what kind of farmers we're talking about. If we're talking about farmers who really basically have nothing in the bank. They live year to year, as farmers often did for many, many generations, centuries of farmers lived year to year. And if it was a good year, everything was fine, and they might have a little bit left over. If it was a bad year, they really struggled. They didn't have huge reserves of finances that could get them over the year. That's one situation. So that, I think we could probably all agree that they needed the Heter Mechira because they really weren't going to be able to make it anywhere whatsoever, and that's what Cook is saying, okay? At the other extreme, let's assume you have people, the farmer, let's assume a farmer comes to me and says, has, you know, $20 million in the bank. And let's assume for our purpose, the $20 million is a lot of money, and you can make it for a year or two on the $20 million. So then if he says, no, I need the Heter Mechira, because if I don't keep my farm going year to year, my whole business will fall apart. So then I all of a sudden, he says, I won't be able to make it. There already I can question it more. And then there's the whole broad ground in the middle. And that, I think, sometimes is where a lot of these conversations happen, where if Cook will say, you know, if somebody's pushed by force of circumstance to have to rely on this leniency, we should comfort that person. I think that's unarguable. Except that I wonder about the definition of force of circumstance. So in Rav Kook's time, I think force of circumstance was in fact probably really, really force of circumstance, even though there was those who disagreed with him, but I think it was probably much more likely. But I think today you could have people who, you can imagine people, you know, just an idea that came into my head, and I'm sorry, I'm going to get back to Rav Kook in a second, but imagine, it's not quite parallel, but imagine, you know, you have people who come to a school and they say, we can't afford the tuition for this school. So schools provide, Jewish day schools provide lots of scholarships, and they want to. And they don't want it to be that if you can't afford it, you can't go. At one extreme, you have people who really, everybody who really can't afford it. You know, you've got five kids, and they're struggling to live in a two-bedroom apartment. They never take a vacation. Every piece of money they go goes to their sustenance. You obviously want to help those people out. At the other extreme, I don't know if you have people like this, but you can, if you imagine somebody who has, you know, again, $20 million in the bank and a thriving business, they come to the school and say, I can't afford it, you'd wonder about it. But in the middle, you have all sorts of people who, they have some savings, not as much as they'd like, not enough to retire on, but they have some savings. They take some vacations. You know, sometimes, let's say, they or some relatives will take them away for, let's say, Pesach and whatever, and they make the kids go to camp. And this. So then already the question of who absolutely needs a scholarship, that's an interesting question. So I think the Rav Kook has touched on a very, very important issue here when he says both sides. He says, obviously, we prefer that everybody keep Shemitah, and yet, if they feel that they can, if they really can, he says if they can. The question is, if they feel they can, whether that's accurate or not. But if they feel they can, then we have to make them feel better about themselves, not feel like they're rishayim. They're relying on a leniency that was there for them. He says, for example, now we're going to get into halachic material. There is a shita, there's an opinion of the Baal Hamor, of Zachi Halevi, which the Ravid originally accepted and then changed his mind for whatever reasons, but it wasn't obviously so crazy to the Ravid that he rejected it out of hand. He originally held that way. So the Baal Hamor held, the Bizman Hazel, like a klal din shvita afilu derabanan. The Baal Hamor held that Shemitah was never reinstated. I mean, there's a whole question about the status of Eretz Yisrael today, the status of Eretz Yisrael after the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. The Gemara is clear that Kudusha Rishona, Kitcha L'Shaita V'lo Kitcha L'Tilavo, that the first time the Jewish people took over the land of Israel and gave it a certain sanctity by virtue of their conquering it, that when they were exiled to Bavel and the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed at the end of the first Beit HaMikdash, that sanctity went away. The Kudusha Shnia, the second sanctity, never went away, but it's unclear in the Gemara and in the Rishonim as to whether that Kedusha is a Kedusha, a full Kedusha of the right to Kedusha, or is really only Rabbinic Kedusha. If it's only Rabbinic Kedusha, then that means that all sorts of halakhot only apply to Rabbanan. So that's, I think, our general assumption, is that various halakhot only apply to Rabbanan, including, for example, Shemitah. That when they got back to Eretz Israel, they didn't recreate Eretz Israel in its fullest extent, such that all of the halakhot, the biblical halakhot, apply in their full force. But Chazal instituted many, or all of those halachot, at a rabbinic level, so that Eretz Yisrael would function like it was supposed to function, although only at a rabbinic level. The Baal Hamor held that while that's true for other halachot, it's not true for Shemitah. The Shemitah was never put back into place. So if Cook says, even if that's all you had, even if every other Rishon says that's crazy, there's no such thing, right? The Baal Hamor holding that way is enough to rely on to say that. The Baal Hamor held that it was that way because we don't have an actual court being Mekadesh Shanim. So there's all discussion about how we have the calendar today and how the calendar works, and that we're not going to get into that because it's not here in the Tshuva. But in the olden times, right, the calendar was set by witnesses coming for every month, and then as every new year came along, the Beit Din would say, this is the next year of the Shemitah cycle. This is year two of the Shemitah cycle. This is year three of the Shemitah cycle. So the Baal Hamor held, unless you have a Beit Din defining the years, even though we can count ourselves, he said that unless you have the count happening, it doesn't create a Shemitah thing. That's what the Baal Hamor held. And it seems like the Sma, who's an important early Acharon on Chosh and Mishpat, held similarly that we don't have Shemitah today for other reasons. So Rav Kook says, even with just those two great Gedolim, those are great, important halakhic authorities, they held halakhic opinions. If a farmer were to say, to himself, he almost makes it sound like, meaning he almost makes it sound like they don't even consult with rabbis about it. But let's assume they consult with rabbis, and rabbis say, listen, really, almost everybody in Halacha thinks you have to observe the Shemitah today. Baal Hamor thinks you don't have to, and the Sma seems to think you don't have to as well. And you've got these terrible financial situations. He stressed that again and again. A terrible financial pressure, as is true of the settlement in Israel today, he says. Then even if they just rely on that one opinion, we're not supposed to look down on them, right? We've seen it in lots of issues. You find that we rely on the opinion of a certain single authority, and other chachamim, other sages didn't protest that, and that's appropriate. That's, again, a broad halakhic principle that I'm not sure we always notice today. And of course, coming with that is the question of what's defined as tzchak, as pressure, as halakhic emergency situation. But in a halakhic emergency situation, he's saying you rely on a lone opinion, even if it's a lone opinion that nobody relies upon, that we're not supposed to look down on you for that. That's the way it goes sometimes. And now he says, even on Doraita issues. So for example, and this is a principle that he's pointing out that's true even today, we build all of our Eruvin on based on the idea that you don't have a Reshut HaRabim at a Doraita level, you don't have a public thoroughfare at a Doraita level, at a biblical level in our times. And that's, it's not a lone opinion, but it's a minority opinion. If you look at the Rishonim, it's an opinion, I think, in Rashi, and it also, they come with this idea that unless you have 600,000 people traversing a particular place, it's not a Rishud HaRabim D'Oraita. So today, maybe there'd be some that are D'Oraita, but it gets rid of really, really many, many large cities and metropolises from having Rishud HaRabim D'Oraita, allowing for the building of Eruvin. Of course, he doesn't say you shouldn't be building those Eruvin. He's just pointing out that to build those Eruvin, you're relying on a minority opinion because, and he says, and it's not even such a terrible pressure. The other pressure is people need to carry on Shabbos. People need to carry because the way we live, you want to be able to roll the baby in a baby stroller. You want to take food from one friend's house to another friend's house. There are all sorts of good reasons why you want to have an Eruv. But those good reasons, like one Eruv, are not even close to I'll starve because I have no livelihood unless I work my farm. So if Cook is saying, see, you rely on a minority opinion. So too with Chadash. So there's a halachic, and the halach of the Torah is that you're not really supposed to use any wheat grown after the previous Pesach until the next Pesach. So depending on where you live and the growing season which you live, it can be a real problem because if there's winter wheat, I think it's called, and if there's wheat that's grown in the winter, let's say in the United States of America, and it's harvested before Pesach, and it's in the stores before Pesach, you have a big problem. Or even autumn wheat would be a problem, right? Any wheat or summer wheat could be a problem, right? If you have summer wheat grown in July, August, let's say in the United States of America, hits the stores in some kind of processed form, bread or cookies or whatever it is, in October, November, December. So the laws of Chadash are that you can't use it until, you couldn't use it until the next Pesach when they would have offered the Omer. The Omer that we were talking about, just was counting it, but the Omer was a sacrifice, it was offering, a barley offering, and it was Matir the Chadash. So even today, when you don't have the offering, so we say until the 16th of Nisan, you can't use Chadash. So Jews outside of Israel rely upon these tremendous kulot, and they are minority opinions. He mentions the Taz, I think there's also a Bach, but these are minority opinions that say that there are reasons why we are not allowed, we're not required to worry about Chadash outside of Israel today. Maybe it's because it belongs to a non-Jew, maybe because that's, so there are all sorts of problematic claims that are being made. His point is not to say you shouldn't rely on it. I know, you know, people I know held very strongly that Jews outside of Israel should be making very sure not to eat Chadash, and there are nowadays many more bakeries and things like that that will make sure that you don't eat Chadash, but it's a leniency in the 1909. It's a leniency that a lot of people rely upon, and they rely upon it even though it's a minority opinion. So that's true about just being able to have bread and wheat and, you know, and grain products. But kal vachomer, all the more so on a matter, I think that most people think is derabbanan, that if you're going to sell it at a derabbanan level, that you have what to rely upon. And then he says, and that's all true in situations where the obligation, the mitzvah, is very clear. Except that, in our times, he says, this mitzvah of Shemitah is not at all clear. Why is it not at all clear? Because there's a great discussion in halachic sources about which year is actually the Shemitah year. The calendar we have and the count that we have is not so clear at all. In fact, he says, we don't have any way to fully decide which year is the Shemitah year. The Rav Levi Ibn Chabib writes in his Tshuvot that there are four different years that might be possibly the Shemitah year, and Rav Kook adds, I think there's another year that might be, a fifth year might be a problem, because of the, depending on how you count Yovlot, how you count the 50th year, whether you do or don't count, and that works. Every 350 years, every seven Yovlot, it comes around again to being a Shemitah question. So, even if Shemitah was a D'Oraita issue, it would become a Suffolk, and therefore become a D'Rabbanan, because we don't know which year is the Shemitah year. As a parallel, he points out, there's an opinion of the Eli Arava, which was an authoritative halachic work, about the following situation that comes with the Gemara. The Gemara talks about somebody gets lost in a desert, and however it is that they survive in the desert, but they can't get out of the desert, and they lose track of the days of the week. So thank God I've never been in a situation, but it seems like that's something that happens. If you're in a situation where there aren't people around, and time sort of runs on you because you're so busy thinking about survival and maybe trying to get out of where you are, you can lose track of the days of the week. Why is it a problem for a Jew? It's a problem for a Jew because you don't know which day is Shabbos. So the Gemara has a whole discussion about it and how you handle it, but the Gemara seems to think that, by and large, one day a week you'll make Kiddush and make sure that you declare that Shabbos, and the other days of the week that you just sort of pick. You know, you count 5 days, I think you count 5 or 6 days because you know you didn't leave on a Shabbos. So from the when you realize, you count however many days you know that wasn't Shabbos, and then you keep Shabbos, and then you keep Shabbos every seventh day from then on. But on all the other days, the Gemara says, you're allowed to do what you need to do to keep yourself alive, because that's Pikuach Nefesh, so even if it were Shabbos, you'd be allowed to do that. But other than that, it seems like you're not allowed to do very much because you have to worry that maybe it's Shabbos. So the Eli Rabbah said, that's true for Torah prohibitions. But for Shvutim, for rabbinic prohibitions, he thinks you would be allowed to do that, meaning he thinks that as soon as you have a doubt about a Doraita issue, and you don't know whether this is the Doraita day when certain rabbinic problems or issues or rules would apply, he thinks they don't have to apply misafik. That's an important halakhic principle, and that would therefore also reflect on the Shemitah question. If I don't know which year is the Shemitah, even if Shemitah is a Doraita obligation in our times, once it becomes a matter of Suffolk, and I don't know if it's year X, Y, or Z, so that leads to all sorts of leniencies in what I'm allowed to do, particularly in the rabbinic issues that come up. So then there's a Ran in Psachim that seems to go against this idea that you can rely on that when it's a rabbinic issue and you don't know which one to follow, you don't have to follow all of them necessarily, you don't have to do about it. So the Ran has that in a different situation. We in the Gemara have a discussion about whether one is supposed to lean for the first two of the four cups of Pesach or the last two of the four cups of Seder night. So that debate, whatever the reasons are, we can't get into them here, but that debate is what leads to us eventually deciding to lean for all of them. Problem is, the Ran sort of suggests that that's a problem because the reasons are contradicting to each other. I forget right now what they are. The reasons are like one is leading into Chayrut, one is expressing Chayrut, or something like that. But the reasons are contradicting each other. So if you lean for the first two, you should absolutely not lean for the last two. And if you lean for the last two, you should absolutely not lean for the first two. So the Ran doesn't understand how we can say, well, we'll do both because we're contradicting each other. So the Ran says that over there, if you didn't do both, you'd have to do one or the other, right? But we don't want to do one or the other because then we're apostling like that, and we want to worry that the other one might be right. So if we tried to be worried about both of them, we wouldn't do anything. So if your attempt to worry about all of them is going to get you to do nothing, he says that can't be right, then you'll do everything. So here when the Shemitah question comes up, the Rav Kook says, you might think that should mean that since you don't know which year is the Shemitah year, but if it's going to lead you to never keep a Shemitah year, that can't be right. So he says, no, he thinks that's different. When the Ran said his idea, the Rishonim there point out, that's because it's not such a big deal, right? How much effort does it take to lean while you're drinking? Not that much. And therefore, it's appropriate and proper to try to fulfill all the positional, all the views on that situation. But when it comes to Shemitah, it's going to take a much greater effort in order to be able to do that. And therefore, he doesn't think you're required. That reasoning applies. And then he points out, and you shouldn't think that I'm, you know, dredging up old material. He says it's true that in the days of the Kaftor of Aferach, Kaftor of Aferach was an important sefer, I think it's by a man who lived in the 14th century, in the 1300s, who lived in Eretz Israel or came to Eretz Israel and wrote Eshtor HaFarachi and wrote up many of the halachot of Eretz Israel. Ishtori HaFarachi was born in Provence in 1280. He passed away in 1355, studied in Provence all yeshivot. Then he moved to Eretz Israel, lived in Beit Shan, was a doctor there, and then he traveled throughout Eretz Israel, and he has a lot of topics in there, but I think it addresses many halakhic issues that have to do with Eretz Israel. So Rav Kook points out that in Kaftor HaFarach, he still doesn't know which is the year to keep the Shemitah year. There was the Rambam had a count, the Gaonim had a count, the Rambam and the Gaonim had different counts. They had a different disagreement about what year should be a Shemitah year. And he compared it to the question of whether we should wear Rashi tefillin or Reinu Tam tefillin, which is still not a settled, which he was saying was still not a completely settled question, and therefore maybe you should wear both, maybe this, but you don't have to, but it's not a completely settled question as to which way it goes. Then he adds, there was a sefer called Sefer Hilchot Eretz Yisrael that had claimed that if you have an Arnona situation, Arnona is when the king, and here we're talking about a non-Jewish king, because if it was a Jewish king, he'd be bound by the same halacha that we're bound by. If the non-Jewish king demands a certain amount of money in taxes, so the examples are, you know, he sort of owns a 10% share of an animal, let's say, or of land. So if the king is going to demand 10% of our profits in taxes, so there, the king might say, and you're not allowed to leave it fallow. It's not meaning, is an income tax where if you happen to make money, I want the money, or I'm expecting this money every year from you. So if you're expecting, the king is expecting the money every year from you, so the Sefer Yisrael held that then you're allowed to work the land not only just enough to be able to make that money, but you're allowed to work the land completely because it's under the king's rule in that sense. Which Rav Kook says seems to mean that he thinks it doesn't count as being owned by the Jew at all, that since it's subject to the rules of the Arnona, the rules of the paying of the taxes and the paying of the fees. Therefore, it doesn't count as being Jews, and therefore, you should be able to rely on the Heter Mechira in this terrible situation that the Jews find themselves in. And he says, and it doesn't count that until now, everybody kept Shemitah, right? Until the late 1800s, everybody kept the Shemitah. He says, that's because there were so few Jews, and among the Jews, there were so few who were farmers who were working the land, it actually wasn't a big deal for them to keep Shemitah and to buy from non-Jews in those years and to follow it fully, because you had no problem. But now, when it's much more of a hard situation for the Yishuv, for the people living in Eretz Israel, and it might lead to the desolation of the land of Israel. And it's very hard to rely just on non-Jews for the food that we eat. And we need this food, we need the product, we need all this. So therefore he thinks it's an obligation to find ways to allow us to shore up the community when it has this great need. So then I skip this. He has this whole long discussion of there was a case in the time of the David Yehuda when there was some huge amount of chametz that became chametz shavar lav Pesach. That was for some reason a Jew, I think unwittingly, owned it over the course of Pesach. So the halacha is that no Jews are allowed to use that after Pesach, but it was going to create a huge financial loss, not just to a particular Jew, but to a whole community. And there was a Rav in that time who held that you could rely on a minority opinion that Chametz Shavar Lav Pesach is not prohibited to everybody else. So that's all discussion, but it's a related idea. The related idea being, when you get into times of trouble, it's part of the obligation of rabbis to find ways to help people keep their Jewish lives alive, Jewish lives functioning well, in a way that halacha can tolerate based on valid halachic opinions that are out there. Along the way, another topic that came up was that Rav Kook seemed to have mentioned in his previous letters to this man that he thought that the Muslims, the Arabs that were living nearby them, could qualify as Gerei Toshav. Gerei Toshav is a halachic category of people who, in a time when there's a functioning Sanhedrin and a functioning court system, would come to that court and declare their desire to be Gerei Toshav, which means they declare their acceptance of the 7 Noahide laws and their plan to live that way, and their, you know, fealty to the Jewish polity, like their recognition that this is a Jewish state, and they want to live in that Jewish state as Gerei Toshav, as strangers in the land, not full citizens, but with many important halachic rights. So Rav Kook had said, so that is a question, because when you sell the land of Israel, if you sell it to an idolater, to an Ovid of Odezora, that's really a huge halakhic problem. And that one, so forget the Shemitah issues. Once you're going to say, well, I'm going to sell it, maybe you're getting yourself into other problems. Rav Kook had held, it's saying that no, selling it to the Arabs is fine, because for these purposes, they qualify as Gerei Toshav. So the other rabbi had pointed out, the Beis Yosef in the Choshen Mishpat, it said, no, we should treat them as Ovdei Avodah Zarah, as idolaters. We can't get into that now, but it comes up with the same thing for Rav Kook. He says, yeah, I have a Bach. The Bach disagrees with the Beis Yosef there, and the Bach infers from the language of the Torah that they're not, that they can be considered like Gerei Toshav in terms of the question of what's called matnat chinam. You're not theoretically, this complicated little issue of its own, but you're not allowed to give a gift to an idolater for no good reason. So you can give gifts to them if it's really part of a business transaction, if it's going to curry favor them for the future, but just give them a gift. If they're really idolaters, we're not supposed to do that, because that's supporting idolaters. It's befriending idolaters, not our topic today. What our topic is, so if I'm going to give the non-Jews in Eretz Israel, I'm going to sell them land of Israel, I'm giving them a place to live in Israel, at least for that year when they're going to own land, aren't they a problem because they're like idolaters? So the Bach had said, and he thought the Bach claimed the Torah held as well. I looked at the Bach very quickly. It's not the only way to read that Bach, but in any case, Rav Kook is saying the Bach holds, and no, in terms of even giving them free gifts with no strings attached, and as well as our topic of giving them chanaya bakarka, giving them some kind of an ownership over a piece of land in Eretz Yisrael, when the Torah says lo yeshvu ba'artzecha, so the Bach seems to think that Arabs would be okay because they're not idolaters. And Rav Kook says that pasuk that says they can't live in your land says because maybe you'll worship their idols, their other small g gods. So if that's true, that the most of our worry about them is they'll lead us to idolatry, and that's what the Shema seems to say as well, that in terms of a matnat chinam, in terms of a gift, it might be that as long as they're a stranger, because the pasuk says o machor lanochri, that you have to sell it to a nochri, but once they're not an idolater, then there might be room to at least sell it to them. And maybe that's okay. And he goes on and he says, this man had actually claimed that you shouldn't rent things to non-Jews, right, in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Kook says, I don't understand. If they qualify as Gerei Toshav, then the Pasuk says in the Torah, they can live among you. So How would they live among you if you're not even going to rent them anything? So he thinks that, Rav Kook thinks, that Arabs, at least back then, at a religious level, because they're Muslims or perhaps even Christians, but Arabs qualified enough as Geir Toshav. Sure, there's a halachic complication that he doesn't bring up, which is the Rambam seems to imply that you can only be a Geir Toshav if you actually go in front of an authoritative court, a court of smuchim, a court of people who have the original smicha and declare your desire to be so, which would seem to imply that we can't have Geir Toshav today. Rav Kook, I think, has been taking the position that while that may be true in the broadest senses of being a Geir Toshav, that there might be specific halachic issues on which we can treat non-Jews like Geir Toshav, including the Arabs at the time to whom they were going to sell Eretz Yisrael as part of the Het Mechira. Therefore, he thought that should be okay as well. Then, the last halakhic point comes up. This is a famous thing. The Briskers are known for distinguishing between Shem Eretz Yisrael and Kedushat Eretz Yisrael. And they say that what the Eretz Yisrael didn't get back when they came back after the Galut of Bavel, the exile to Bavel, was the full sanctity, the full Kedusha. But there's still something called Eretz Yisrael. There's still a name of Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Kook has that same idea here. He doesn't, and he points out that the Kaftar of Aferach has a similar idea, not with the same terminology, which says that there's a difference between Kedushat Eretz Yisrael and Kedushat HaMitzvot. So that Kedushat HaMitzvot would be what the Briskers would call Kedushat Eretz Yisrael. The full sanctity, in terms of all the mitzvot being applicable, that maybe didn't come back. But the fundamental basic idea that this is Eretz Yisrael, this is the land that Hashem gave to our forefathers and to us forever, that it's going to be ours forever, and that we should be trying to settle it as much as we can because of that, that never goes away. So it's similar to, he says, similar to what the Rambam says, famously says about the Beit HaMikdash, that it's the site of the Beit HaMikdash, its full sanctity never went away because that was based on the presence of Hashem, the divine presence, and the divine presence never goes away. Rav Kook says something similar is true about the rest of Eretz Yisrael, that we should be trying to settle it, even if it doesn't have the halakhic, full halakhic sanctity. He says it's obvious, I don't think it was obvious to everybody, it's obvious to him, that the redemption, the geulah, is tzluya b'ribui achenu am kadosh v'arsenu kadoshai. It depends upon having more and more Jews in the land of Israel. And from there, when you get more and more Jews, we today are approaching a time when the majority of Jewish people in Eretz Israel, once the majority of Jewish people in Eretz Israel, some halachot then do become d'oraita. That's what Rav Kook was talking about over 100 years ago. The more Jews that come to Israel, the more step by step we will get back to the fullest sanctity of the land. So by not keeping the Shemitah in its fullest sense, because of this great economic pressure, we're supporting the continued settlement of Israel, which will lead to further settlement of Israel, which will lead to more people coming, and the geula coming. So therefore, he thinks for all these reasons, all this pressure, and the fact that there are good heterium out there, it's no worse than lots of other heterium we rely on. We rely on heterium in terms of animals' lungs. This is the time before everybody ate glot. There were heterium that people relied on. We rely on for chadash. We rely on for lots and lots of issues. So therefore, he says also here, he thinks the stakes are high enough, and the problems are significant enough that you can comfortably, people should feel comfortable relying on the Het Mechira. We should encourage them to feel comfortable about it. We should encourage them not to feel guilty about it. And we should help them feel this way about their observance of the Torah. Like I said, along the way, there are so many halakhic issues that he raises, significant halakhic issues and broad halakhic questions that apply to this Het Mechira question, but to other situations as well that apply to any other application of Het Mechira. Meaning every year now that one would apply that to Mechir, you'd have to ask these same questions again. Is the financial pressure significant? But it applies to lots of other areas of halakha as well. So it's Rav Kook, as masters of halakha always do, enlightening us about a particular halakhic issue, but also pointing out to us many broad questions that we should always know in our halakhic observance that come up over and over again. And that is a responsible day for the second day of Rosh Chodesh Iyar, Rav Kook on the Het HaMechira, with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hochhauser. Have a great day.